For the week of June 12th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 107, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the party is still going strong, I'm Michael Giltz.
I assume you're talking about the Tony Awards.
That's right. The Book of Mormon swept the Tonys, as we expected, and was the big winner. And they even gave a shout out to Mormon Church founder Joseph Smith, rather cheekily at the end of the night. And so the parties are still going strong here in the heart of Mormonism, the Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I should say, which is Salt Lake City, Utah.
Well, you know, I can't go to parties anymore. I'm just too darn old.
What do you mean?
I'm just feeling very old this week.
Is it your birthday?
No, it's not my birthday, but I realized this week while reading the news, the entertainment news, and putting our show notes together, that there are certain people that are growing up that were teenagers when I was in my 20s or weren't even born yet or were like 8 years old. The first one, when I worked for Nicolas Cage, his son Weston was 8 years old. And now he's 20 years old, and I'm reading that he's, you know, getting married, and he's in a rock band, and he's 20 years old.
That's life. Yeah, all my nieces and nephews are, you know, entering college, so it's a sort of a slap in the face.
So I go from that story to one about Hanson, who I could barely remember as being
M-bop.
The M-bop, teeny boppers, who I saw in concert once on the Santa Monica Pier. And it turns out they're now like between the ages of 25 and 30, and they're selling out shows in London, 5 nights worth of shows in London.
Well, where have you been? Hanson never went away. Hanson's been touring and working hard. And, you know, have you not seen them on like Jay Leno or something in the past 5 years or so when they're promoting a new album and gone, oh, yeah, they're all grown up?
No, I thought they were still in high school.
Yeah, no. And, you know, their shows in London, it's not like they're selling out the O2 Arena. They're playing at King's College London Student Union, which is kind of a hip place. I mean, Arcade Fire has played there, but it's not a big venue. And they're doing one of those concerts where they do one album a night. You know, their first night they played their debut album in its entirety, and then their second album the second night, and then other songs as well. But that's sort of the pool for those concerts.
Well, then I go from that story where, you know, a bunch of people who I think are in high school are actually now 30 years old and selling out the King's College Student Union in London, to one about someone I interviewed in 2001, at the end of 2001, in a movie. She starred in this movie with Sean Penn and Michelle Pfeiffer, and everybody was very interested in interviewing both Penn and Pfeiffer for this movie. But then in walks this little girl, I think she was 6 or 7 years old at the time, and she, for half an hour, sat at a table full of 10 to 12 journalists.
Oh, I know who you mean.
And she just won everybody over. She was so cute. She was so endearing. And we all said, gee, we hope we see a lot more of her. Well, it turns out over the last decade, we have seen a lot more of her. Her name was Dakota Fanning. She was 6 or 7 years old at the time. She's graduating from high school this week.
And her sister's in a movie, the number one movie at the box office.
Yes, actually, her sister's quite good in that movie.
Well, before our viewers get any older, what are they going to hear this week?
Well, this week, they will be hearing about the state of 3D movies and why Jeffrey Katzenberg calls their decline heartbreaking. And as you mentioned, the Tonys were held on Sunday evening, and you also mentioned that Mormons are rejoicing the world over. We'll tell you who won, although you just did, and try to decipher what winning a Tony Award means for a show's financial success. Apple announced their iCloud service last week, and we'll try to untangle it for you by reviewing the features of all the major cloud services. We've got some listener email from Andrew Einsbrook from Wild Pure Heart Productions down in Australia. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we begin our movie news by turning it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, and we're back to worldwide box office figures. We got the numbers in early this week. The number one movie at the box office worldwide this week was Kung Fu Panda 2 at $73 million worldwide. It's at $330 million worldwide and counting. Number two at the box office worldwide was X-Men First Class at $67 million. It's at $223 million worldwide. Number three is The Hangover 2 at $56 million. It's at $430 million worldwide and outpacing the original Hangover film. At number five, one, two, three, four, I should say, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides grossed another $52 million. It's at $887 million worldwide, and it's, you know, zooming past $900 million, obviously. At number five, Super 8, which opened mostly in North America, but worldwide it grossed $44.7 million. At number six, Bridesmaids at $10.1 million, basically the U.S. only now. That grossed $123 million so far, but it really hasn't opened overseas. Fast Five at $7.6 million. Judy Moody and the Not Bummer Summer. These are mostly films opening only in North America. Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen movie, it opened wider. It opened to $6.1 million in its widest weekend. It's made $32 million worldwide. And this weekend in North America, $6.1 million. How many decades into his career? It's the biggest weekend of Woody Allen's entire career.
I know. That's remarkable. I could not believe that.
Well, most of his big hits came in the 70s and early 80s when he was making $30, $40 million a movie when that was real money. And those were the eras when, you know, you'd make $1 million, $2 million a weekend and it was a pretty darn good weekend. So, you know, you didn't have wide releases like you do today. So it's not really that surprising. But, you know, his last few movies, he's had Vicky Cristina Barcelona and Match Point have both made $75 to $85 million worldwide. So he has had some really big successes recently. And Midnight in Paris looks like it's going to join them as one of the biggest hits of his career.
And people wonder why that, you know, they keep giving him money to make movies. Well, when you're making $75, $80 million for a film, you know what? Yeah, sure, we'll throw $20 million at you and take a risk.
Well, those are outliers. There was quite a few years when he wasn't doing a lot. But to focus back in on North America, worldwide, of course, Super 8 ranked in at 1, 2, 3, 4, number 5. But in the U.S., which is basically the biggest territory it opened in, it was the number one film at the box office. It grossed $37 million, and that's based on a $50 million budget. So worldwide, it's almost matched its budget opening weekend. That's always a good sign. But was it a success or a failure? Some of the headlines said it exceeded expectations, defied the odds, said the Hollywood Reporter. And other people say, it really hasn't done that well.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people looked at J.J. Abrams, the director of Star Trek and Mission Impossible 3, the creator of Lost and Felicity and Alias. They looked at Steven Spielberg, the producer, and they said, gee, this should be a movie that does, you know, $50, $60, $70 million out of the gate. But then others said, look, you know, you had this marketing campaign that didn't show anything about the movie, didn't show the monster, which is fine. We don't need to see the monster that's in this film, but we need to know a little bit more about the film. You can't just leave us hanging.
What's the problem? It's a movie with virtually no names in it, and it opened number one at the box office. It cost $50 million to make, and it made $37 million its opening weekend. J.J. Abrams is not exactly, you know, Hitchcock yet. It's not like his name is gold at the box office.
No, I agree. I think this is a fine opening for this film because I think this is the type of movie. Did you see the film, first of all?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, and did you like the film?
Not really. It was okay. It had a nice feel. It was a sort of a throwback to the late 70s, early 80s Spielberg canon. Had that feel, that look, the score, everything about it had that vibe. And it was set in 1979. And
that you were kind of in the minority there, don't you think? I mean, it got rave reviews.
No, it did not get rave reviews.
Okay,
no.
I know that the reviews I read were not glowing necessarily, but I saw it. It was good. I enjoyed it. It was nice to actually watch a film where I didn't know the ending because it wasn't based on a comic book.
Well, I thought, many movies aren't. I thought that it was obvious where it was going, but and the movie for me just nailed down every emotional moment towards the end. It was like they didn't let anything be sort of implied. Everything was spelled out. Dad, I miss you because mom is dead. And I'm, you know, it's like every possible thing was just so baldly stated that it was awful at the end. I thought it was embarrassing.
That was the whole Spielberg, you know, directed with a sledgehammer mode. But yeah, I think that you've seen it before, yet it's kind of nice to see again for nostalgic reasons if you grew up in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how it does in the coming weekends. I thought the lead kid was good. I thought Ellie Fanning was good. Kyle Chandler is the father figure, and he's fine. You know, so it was not an awful movie, but I think it really did let down the side by the finale.
I thought the Fanning sister was fantastic. I thought she did a great job.
Well, fantastic is a little strong for me, but I thought she was, you know, quite good in her, you know, especially in her. They're making a movie inside the movie. The kids are filming their own little home movie. You know, Wish Super 8, obviously. And she has a couple of scenes that she does really good in.
And I'm not giving anything away to tell you that there was a train crash in this movie. What did you think of that train crash?
It was a good train crash.
It was, I mean, it lasted for like 5 minutes into it. I went, is it, you know, can a train crash for this long?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at Metacritic and Super 8 has a score of 72 from critics. That's not exactly, you know, a big strong one. But there are some very positive ones. Entertainment Weekly liked it a lot. Time Magazine liked it a lot. You know, so it's definitely not. Roger Ebert liked it. You know.
Yeah, and Kenneth Turan didn't necessarily like it. He didn't hate it, but I think he had a great review in which he kind of said, look, you know, J.J. Abrams is a good director when he's directing like J.J. Abrams, but J.J. Abrams trying to direct like Spielberg, not necessarily that great. You don't get the best of any world.
Well, I think you look at the budget, you look at the opening weekend, this is a successful launch. So just like Cloverfield, they kept everything very mysterious, and when you saw the movie, you might have thought like, eh, but you know, if the movie delivers and people like it, it's okay. They're already making their money back.
Yeah, I think they'll do fine with this film, and I think it will kind of have a bit of legs. I think it won't drop off as much as everybody thinks next weekend. But, you know, it wasn't in 3D, though, so, you know, it didn't get that 3D bump.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, well, you know, certainly when Kung Fu Panda opened, and even before that, Pirates of the Caribbean was the first film, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, the first film where more people chose to see the film in 2D rather than in 3D. The next weekend, same thing happened for Kung Fu Panda 2.
So these were movies designed to be seen in 3D.
That's right. They were actually shot and or produced in 3D, not retrofitted for 3D or converted to 3D. And then this weekend, we had Jeffrey Katzenberg on Friday speaking to The Hollywood Reporter about the heartbreaking decline of 3D.
Right. He's been the biggest, one of the biggest cheerleaders alongside James Cameron for 3D as a way to boost attendance and make going to the movies special.
Right. I remember actually at the 2007 Show East convention, he had a keynote address talking about 3D before the big boom, before 2009 and Avatar. And he said, you know, we're not really allowed to tell you how much to increase ticket prices. But, and he held up his hand, you know, like to wave to the audience, like, you know, all five fingers. We think that, you know, you could go, you know, substantially higher in your ticket prices. And he kept waving his five fingers up in the air, trying to say, $5 increase, please.
Right. Well, and that's one of the big things he argues against. He says a lot of movies have come out that have been done poorly, you know, retrofitting and things like that. He said, we haven't done that at DreamWorks, but a lot of other people had. And so people go to the movies and they're disappointed. He does not accept the argument at all about this massive ticket price increase, especially when you're looking at a family with kids in the heartland. You know, they're not in New York or LA where tickets are $12. They're spending $7 or $8 and matinees or kid prices are $5 or $6. And then you're tacking on a $3 fee for the glasses. And that's a 50% increase. And he doesn't accept at all the idea that people are saying, you know what, it's not worth it.
Yeah, he says that 3D is in the middle of its terrible twos and that we've disappointed audiences with multiple movies that really just didn't use 3D properly, as you've mentioned. And then, you know, he really goes on to say that it's a shame because we've, you know, Hollywood has kind of snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, were his words.
Right. But he's arguing, hey, everybody has variable pricing. Everybody wants to charge a premium and tack on extras. We didn't take a plane and convert it all to first class, is a quote from him. You know, we still let people choose to see a movie in 2D if they want, you know, and when they say there's price pressure and all that, you know, please give me a break, you know. I don't agree at all. They don't charge extra for the widescreen. They don't charge extra for sound. They don't charge extra for color. And all those things were special at the beginning. But if it keeps people going to your theater and having a better time than staying in their home, you should be happy about that. That should be plenty for you. The argument that we should pay extra for a big screen, these fake IMAX screens, or pay extra for good sound, or pay extra for 3D is malarkey.
Well, especially at a time where attendance is flat, if not down. I think it was pointed out by one article I read over the weekend that Super 8's attendance was not really all that high. In fact, it wasn't higher or wasn't much higher than E.T., the extraterrestrial, on the same weekend back in 1982. And Super 8 had three times the number of screens and locations.
Well, whatever. It does, you know.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is you can see a shift in a cultural shift in what people do with their free time.
No, people spend more money on going to the movies and buying movies and renting movies than ever before in history. People spend a ton of money going to the movies and consuming movies. That's not the issue. The issue is we don't say, well, this movie costs $2 million to make, so we'll only charge you $3 admission. And this movie costs $100 million to make, so we'll charge you $8 admission. You know, we don't care. We just want to see a movie. And to make us pay extra for 3D is annoying.
Well, but there is some argument that has been made that a movie like Avatar should cost more than a small film like Winter's Bone.
No, the only argument is from the people in Hollywood, not from the people who buy tickets. We've always had road shows and things like that over the years. They have special showings of movies. You book your seat, you get a little booklet. They did that in the 50s and 60s. And you know what? All those things fell by the wayside. They always come up again, but the audiences in general hate it.
Well, the whole booklet thing and the extras might work on a one-off here and there. But certainly I would agree with you. Over time, especially during a recession, people do watch where they're spending their money. And right now, a $3 upcharge for a 3D film, I'll just wait.
Yeah. And, you know, look at one of the biggest movies of the past, the biggest franchises, Spider-Man.
That's right.
Not in 3D, thank God. A terrific trilogy of movies, you know, variable quality, but basically delivering the goods, and people flock to the movies.
Well, now, I know you're bringing this up because, unfortunately, Laura Ziskin, the producer of those movies, passed away over the weekend.
That's right. She was famous for producing Spider-Man, the trilogy, as well as Pretty Woman back in the day. And she died at 61, quite young, from breast cancer. And she had spent the last 3 years of her life trying to raise money to bring awareness to and bring funds for research and other things to fight cancer.
Yeah, and she produced lots of movies, To Die For with Nicole Kidman and As Good As It Gets with, Jack Nicholson. Yeah, I was trying to remember Helen Hunt.
Yeah.
So she's a really well-known producer. So it's kind of sad that she passed away. And so we figured we had to mention that. Now, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Spider-Man 4, which she was in the process of producing, it's the reboot of Spider-Man. That is going to be in 3D, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know.
I believe it is. But I can almost guarantee you that the next Tron film will be in 3D.
Because the last one was, or because
pretty much, yeah, that's why I can guarantee it.
Yeah, this is the sequel to Tron Legacy, which you may be wondering, why is there a sequel coming out? Tron Legacy was kind of a disappointment, right?
I watched it. I thought, wow, this is beautiful to look at. I am so not emotionally involved in this movie at all.
Kind of like the original Tron,
exactly.
It cost $200 million to make. It grossed $400 million worldwide, which means basically you didn't lose your shirt.
Maybe you make some money off of the Disneyland rides and all the toys and all of the,
but those toys and things don't work well when the movie's not a big hit. It's sometimes it does, but this is not a question of like the Pixar film Cars, where the merchandising was a wild success. From what I understand, all the tie-ins to Tron Legacy were not some huge successful thing.
I couldn't tell you, but I could tell you that Cars, I was walking past Williams-Sonoma the other day. And sure enough, I'm looking in there, and they have Cars cupcake molds and Cars cookie cups.
Oh,
I couldn't believe it.
My friend Pete's son, the son saw a Cars 2 novelization, like a picture book. He's bought it for his son. He's read it like every night for 3 weeks now. He knows it by heart, and the kid can barely say the names, but he knows all the characters from all the international car places around the world. Francisco, and the car from Germany and the car from Japan. He can't wait for the movie, and he's like 4.
Well, remember when we were in Cannes, there were those, the big giant Cars characters outside the Carlton, and when I went to take pictures of them for my kids, there was maybe a 3-year-old with his family. He was dressed in a car shirt. He had both little toy cars and one in each hand. He had a Cars hat on and Cars shorts on, and he was having his picture taken in front of the big giant Cars character cutouts. I thought, well, I guess this movie's a success.
Oh, yeah. The Cars 2 is going to be massive. I don't think people even realize how big it's going to be. But that brings us back to the question, why are they potentially making a sequel to Tron Legacy? And the answer is television. When you launch a movie like this, you have to plan all these tie-ins in advance. You plan the picture books and the games and the video games and the t-shirts and the posters. All that stuff has to be done well in advance. Same thing with a TV spinoff. More and more you're seeing movies have built-in sort of spinoffs going on cable channels or networks planned a year or two in advance before the movies even come out.
As opposed to like MASH, which has its debut in 1969 and then about 10 years later has a spinoff.
Well, it's a very different, nobody would even expect it a spinoff from the film MASH.
Well,
but
right.
Yeah. So this TV series is called Tron Uprising, and it was already in the works, and it's going to air on Disney HD, which is a Disney channel on cable, obviously in high definition, in 2012. Now, they had to commit, obviously. It takes quite a long time to have an animated series be on the air. So they committed to it before the movie came out, And now they're waiting to see how the TV show does. If the TV show does well, that will be the spur, perhaps, to make them make a new movie.
Well, sometimes that does happen, right? I mean, I'm trying to think of a good example of a TV show being popular enough to spur a movie.
Revive a failed franchise.
Yeah.
And the other thing is they spent a lot of money on the technology for the first movie, you know, for the first reboot. And all of that work is available. So it'll be cheaper, just like potentially Avatar 2 and 3 might be a little cheaper in the sense that they've already done the base work. They're going to do a ton more work, but they've done that basic level of technology development to make it possible. And so now they build on it.
Yeah, you say that, but I've got to say I was in a meeting last week and I don't want to derail us too much, but remind me for a future episode, we have to talk about high frame rates and shooting in high frame rates and what that means for motion picture exhibition and seeing movies.
Well, we've done that at some point, but I'll be interested to hear what the latest news is. But it's certainly not DVD sales that are prompting them to do it. Tron Legacy grossed $172 million at the box office in North America. The only figure I could find for what it made on DVD was $22 million.
I'm surprised it made that much.
Well, but that's really low. I mean, it used to be you could expect to do equal or even double your box office gross for a while there on DVD. To do, you know, like 15% of your box office, that's pretty amazing.
Well, now you've highlighted another show here or another animated film here that's going to be going back into movie theaters based on a TV show, and that's Looney Tunes.
That's right. I got this email saying that there would be some Looney Tunes shorts coming up in the fall in movie theaters. Yeah, they're going to be a new Looney Tunes short in front of Happy Feet 2. They've got three, I think, that they're planning to do right now. They're going to be in 3D. Two of them include voice work by the late Mel Blanc. I guess they're able to use his dialogue from previous things or some recordings he's done and put them into a newly written and directed and created Looney Tunes short. You've got, like, I Thought I Thaw Putty Tat. That's one of them. So clearly you've got Tweety Bird and Sylvester, and you've got one with Elmer Fudd chasing, I think it's Daffy Duck. I don't think it's Bugs necessarily. And I'm like, I wonder what prompted this. Well, it turns out it's a TV show. The Looney Tunes show is on Cartoon Network right now. It launched in May, and it airs on Tuesdays at 8 o'clock. But I think they realized, you know, Looney Tunes is not in the air in the zeitgeist the way it used to be. It used to be airing on Saturday mornings in reruns for decades, and that sort of ended. And I think that they're wanting to sort of rebrand Looney Tunes and bring it back to attention and give it a sort of an air of excitement. So they decided to create new shorts, give young directors a chance to show their skills without making a, you know, $200 million animated blockbuster. They get to make a short, do it in 3D, put it in front of some of their movies, bring attention to the TV show, make it a fertile proving ground for some young talent. You know, everybody wins.
Well, if you want a brand, then you have to stoke the brand. You have to kind of nurture the brand. You can't just expect Bugs Bunny to remain a brand because you say it's a brand. And so there's a whole bunch of people like my kids who, when I say Looney Tunes and when I say Bugs Bunny, they say, who?
Wow.
And so you have to put this content in front of children if you want them growing up with it and for it to remain a brand in their mind.
Yeah, I'm always amazed that Mickey Mouse still has such high... He's had virtually nothing going on for, you know, decades.
Yes, but Disney does keep putting Mickey Mouse in front of you in one way or another, especially when you go to the theme parks.
Yeah.
Well, that does kind of move us along, though, into music news. And last week we were talking about Lady Gaga and how she sold a million albums and how this was the biggest opening since, you know, 2005. And this week she's in second place.
Well, that's perfectly natural. Who's at number one?
Adele. She decided to return to first place.
Even though she had to cancel her tour, she's still back on top with music sales.
Yeah, just goes to show you what a real hit single can do. And a good album.
Absolutely. No, it's really one of the big hits of the year. She's a real talent, as we've said many times before.
Well, now I want to know, what does your friend Mother Nature think of Adele's new record?
My friend Mother Nature?
Well, yeah, aren't you friends with Mother Nature? Because you did actually ask Mother Nature to cancel the Black Eyed Peas show over at Central Park there in New York, right? So you wouldn't have to go? Because I know you're such a huge fan of the Black Eyed Peas.
This was a benefit concert for the Robin Hood Foundation. I really hate it when they take over Central Park and make it an exclusive event. They did it for like the Pocahontas premiere for Disney. Some big corporate entity or somebody takes over an area and has a concert that's not open to everybody, and yet it's a big, huge, time-consuming, park-consuming event. This is, you know, they were expecting 60,000 people. Great that it was for, you know, charity. And you're going to have Taylor Swift, Carole King, Tony Bennett, LL Cool J. All these people are going to show up to, you know, perform along with the Black Eyed Peas. But I, even for charity, I don't like it when they have concerts on the great lawn in the park and it's not for anybody who shows up. They shouldn't do it.
Well, they didn't do it because it got rained out.
Yeah, well, that's true. But unlike them, Paul McCartney will be performing in New York.
At your favorite place, Yankee Stadium.
Yes, you know, he's coming to Yankee Stadium. They just added a second show. He'll be performing on July 15th and July 16th. Of course, Paul McCartney has played Shea Stadium, the bastard. You should start with Yankee Stadium. But he played Shea both with the Beatles and as a solo act.
Now, this is the other, or was the other stadium in New York City.
It still is. It's got a renamed. You know, they've both been rebuilt. But yeah, it's, you know, it's still City Field or whatever you want to call it. It's Shea, as far as I'm concerned. It's $280 to see the concert. I just can't bring myself to do it. I've seen him in concert. If I hadn't, I might feel obliged to do it. I love the Beatles, but that's just too much money for me.
Well, $280, that's how much you would spend to go to Bonnaroo or to Coachella. And I saw Paul McCartney at Coachella a couple of years ago. I think it was 2009. And he played a three-hour set. I paid $280 and got to see him, got to see all of the other acts that weekend.
Exactly. I'm a huge music fan. I go to a fair number of concerts. I'm not going to spend a lot of money to see one act in one venue. It just doesn't happen for me. But of course, you can see that happening in the concert too overall. I think it was Newsweek, was it, that had an infographic on the concert touring business. You look at 2009 to 2010, the concert business dropped about $400 million and ticket sales dropped pretty dramatically from $45 million tickets sold to 38 million tickets sold among the top 50 tours in North America.
Right. I mean, this is, an infographic that was really done for Bonnaroo, which was held over this past weekend in Tennessee. And unfortunately, someone died in the campgrounds. A girl died in the campgrounds. Mm-hmm. And apparently, like, 9 people have died at that festival in its 10-year history. I was just shocked to read that.
Well, what did she die of?
Probably heat exhaustion, because last year, the minimum heat index for all 4 days was 100 degrees, and this year it was the same. So most of these people are dying either in car accidents or due to heat exhaustion or, you know, dehydration. But I guess we should move on to some of these other numbers here. 80,000 attendees for Bonnaroo in 2010.
And how does that compare?
It's they try to keep it the same every year. How much money do you think it adds to the local economy?
Oh, 80,000 people over, is it a weekend?
Yeah, 4 days.
4 days, well, with the hotels and things like that, I don't know.
$20 million.
Yeah, $5, $10 million was my guess. $20 million, that's a huge bump.
Yeah, in gas alone, it's $5.8 million. And they create 489 tons of waste. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, that's what those festivals do, and I assume that they also pay a lot to clean up and clear up after themselves.
Right, and now, the top attended concerts of all time. What do you think the top attended concert of all time is, and where do you think it took place?
Single concert?
Yes.
Wasn't it something like in Latin America with U2 or something at one point?
I thought it was too, like the Mexico City U2 tour or the Rio U2. It's not. It was a Monsters of Rock festival in Moscow, 1.4 to 1.6 million people in 1991.
Wow.
And then, ironically, I read about this festival over the weekend, and then it was again here in this statistic. The second most attended rock concert of all time was Steve Wozniak's U.S. festival in California in 1983 with 670,000 people.
Worldwide?
Worldwide.
That doesn't make sense.
I didn't know about it either, but you know, I'm reading this.
No, I've heard of it, but that 600,000 doesn't seem big enough. I know there have been like Rio and stuff with bigger than that. In my mind, it seems like.
Woodstock at 400,000.
Well, Woodstock is many, many years ago. I'm not surprised that wouldn't be up there.
Yeah, well, and let's see, Isle of Wright, 600,000. So yeah, I mean, there's
yeah, definitely those are 40 years ago. But I can't believe that there hasn't been something bigger than the Wozniak Festival. 600,000 just doesn't seem big enough. I've just done a quick look online, and there seem to be a lot of concerts worldwide that have been bigger than that Steve Wozniak Festival. Rod Stewart played to 3.5 million people in Copacabana Beach in Rio. It was New Year's Eve, but still they showed up for his concert. The Stones played there to 1.5 million people. This new age artist, Jean-Michel Jarre, who's very big in Europe, he's done 4 concerts with more than 1 million people who've shown up. You've got Garth Brooks in Central Park, which was almost 1 million people. Queen in Sydney, Australia, they played to 2 million people, on and on and on. Seems there are a lot of examples that probably definitively beat out that concert.
Where is that figure coming from? Top attended concerts of all time. You know what? Get Newsweek on the line for me.
I will, but it could be expensive because I'm not a subscriber.
Oh, that's true.
But, and I'm not going to subscribe anytime soon, and I'm not going to pay a lot of money to go to a rock concert.
Well, if you're not going to pay a lot of money to go to a rock concert, will you play some music?
Sure.
I mean, you know how to play an instrument?
I'm really a lead singer type guy.
Okay, well then I guess you'll have to get somebody else to play the Google guitar.
I heard about this. My friend Aaron was telling me what a big hit this was.
Yeah, this was a doodle, which is what the logos are for Google. That's what they're called when they change them for a specific holiday like St. Patrick's Day or Valentine's Day. They'll change their logo into a doodle, which, you know, changes the actual typeface and everything. Well, this one was an actual interactive doodle. It was for Les Paul's 96th birthday, Les Paul being the inventor of the electric guitar, and you could actually play the guitar.
That's very cool. I'm not sure how did it work? Did you have to have a touchpad or did you use a mouse or how did it go?
Either way, you could either use the touchpad or mouse, and you know, the strings on the doodle could actually vibrate and make sounds.
So is Google just having fun with this, or does this help them maintain a face of sort of a warmth and humanness about this massive corporation?
I think both. I think they're having fun with it. I think it brings some marketing power and marketing dollars in. I think it also makes them more human.
Yeah, that's true. It sounds like cool. And marketing power definitely came to Broadway this week. We had the Tony Awards, which we mentioned at the top of the show. The audience was up a little bit this year. It was 6.9 million viewers, obviously not a lot, but it's up 9% over last year, and Neil Patrick Harris did a great job hosting again. He'll certainly be nominated for another Emmy for that one.
Yeah, I thought he did a great job. I agree with you.
Yeah, and his duet with Hugh Jackman about who was the better host, I think, was one of the high points of the show.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman, the actor, and of course, Broadway star.
Tony-winning Broadway star.
That's right. He's hosted, I think, the Tonys three times.
I forget. He mentioned it on the show in a joke, but I forget, a couple times.
Yeah, well, it was, I mean, rather than go over all the winners, I guess we could
main winners were The Book of Mormon, which won 9 Tonys, perhaps a little bit more than Brian Scott Lipton predicted when he was our guest last week. But Brian did nail the hardest category of all, which I think was Best Actor. He predicted Mark Rylance would win, a terrific British actor, and he did win for Jerusalem, and he quoted another poem by this relatively obscure poet that he loves, and it's just a wacky highlight of the show. YouTube it if you haven't seen it.
He talking about? I mean, he got up there. I swear I was like, he's either on shrooms, LSD, he's drunk. What is this guy doing?
He is reciting a poem.
Okay. Well,
he's reciting a poem by one of his favorite poets, who is a poet from Minnesota called Lewis Jenkins. And he did it when he won the Tony for Boeing, and people had no idea what was going on. That was back in 2008. He did it again this year, a different poem. This one was about how you walk through walls. He's just a total oddball free spirit and one of the best actors alive today. So that was very fun. Again, YouTube that. But the big winners were The Book of Mormon with 9 Tonys.
Including Best Musical.
Of course, War Horse, the big British import, which won 6 Tonys, including Best Play. And the best revivals were Anything Goes in musical and The Normal Heart in best play.
And they also won, you know, Sutton Foster won for Anything Goes, and
Normal Heart won 2 acting awards. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the big winners often, just like with the Grammy Awards, the big winners at the Tonys tend to be those shows that get the biggest bounce out of the show. And it's not necessarily who wins the top awards. It's who puts on the best show within the show. All the big musicals get a chance to show their stuff.
Including musicals that haven't even opened yet, I might add. I was a little shocked to see that they did a Spider-Man bit in the middle.
Well, I wasn't shocked because it was one of the biggest talked about shows, and it's been running for 177 performances. That's more than, frankly, a majority of shows in history.
Well,
it's been in previews for, you know, most of a year. Most shows closed before that.
What did you think of Bono and the Edge? Of course, they're the composers for the music. What did you think of what they had to say about the show?
And nothing. They just introduced a number to the show. They were amusing and fine, and you know, they did their job. They were there. The Tonys asked them to perform a number, but they said, no, we want to keep the focus on the leads. And so they sort of introed a number from Spider-Man. The choice of song, of course, this is what I want to get to. Who did a good job of picking a number and presenting the show in the best possible light? Who did the best job? Who won the Tony Awards by putting on the best performance? Spider-Man chose to do a ballad. I think it's called No More. It was with Peter Parker and Mary Jane sitting on a fire escape. And it was this sort of dull, boring ballad. He's not Spider-Man. He's not in the Spider-Man outfit. You're not getting any Spider-Man feel about it. Could be any two young people. Didn't even feel like a rock song. And I feel it was not a very strong selling point for the show.
Yeah, it probably wasn't a strong selling point for the show, though the music was good. So if part of the complaints about that show so far have been that the music isn't any good, that song was okay. Granted, I don't think it was necessarily your Tony number, but they probably couldn't bring all of the, you know.
Well, no, they couldn't do the gymnastic, but they could have had a number where he was at least Spider-Man.
Right.
You know, where he's sort of in the, at least you see him with the, in the outfit with the mask off and singing the song. But so I think that was a missed opportunity.
I thought How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying did a great job with Daniel Radcliffe.
And John Larroquette, who won the Tony for Best Supporting Actor. I agree. They did Brotherhood of Man, the big finale number from the show. It was terrifically done, really entertaining. Daniel Radcliffe showed he was, you know, he could do it, he could deliver. And it was fun, it was light, it was airy. It was exactly what you want from a Tony Awards performance. It makes people want to walk out and go see the show.
Right. I think the same thing was true of Anything Goes. If you like revivals, you'd love that particular performance.
Yeah, they were singing, they were dancing. I do have to say at this point, however, that the Tony Awards was very poorly directed, especially the musical numbers. They were cutting to just a few people in the chorus on the right-hand side who were not even fully lit. They were trying to cut here and there and add a little drama. It's true it's not exciting for them when they have a wide shot, but that's exactly when, you know, shows look really well, when you can see all the cast dancing together in unison and see what they're doing. When you're trying to cut and cut and cut and create some fake excitement by doing that, you miss the beauty and excitement of people performing live on stage. And I thought it was a very poorly directed show.
Well, I think we'll talk about the show in just a second, because MovieLine has this post today about five lessons the Oscars can learn from the Tony Awards. Are you finished talking about which shows did the best during last night's Tony Awards? I would say the Book of Mormon really just, you know, blew the roof off.
Well, that's interesting you should say that. You haven't seen the show. A lot of people who'd seen the show were wondering, why did they choose that number? But you have
to remember,
I wondered
that myself, and I haven't seen it. So
yeah, most of the, I saw it Friday night. It was very funny. I recommend it. It didn't kill me because I'd heard so much buildup, of course. I would look forward to seeing it again. I highly recommend it. But a lot of people who'd seen the show said, why did they pick that number? I believe. And because it doesn't feature the two leads. It features just one of the leads. But most of their numbers are not performable on the Tony Awards. There is so much cursing in this show. The vast majority of the numbers simply are not an option. That's point number one. And point number two is you're trying to sell the show to people in the heartland, to people who aren't sophisticated New Yorkers. You're trying to get the tourist trade to come see your show or to see it when it goes on tour, which the Book of Mormon certainly will. And in that case, this number, which was it was funny, and it made little funny jokes about religion, but it also was about a guy promulgating his faith. It actually, I think, would have played really, really well in the heartland. They could say, okay, it's a funny show. It's making jokes, but there's something there I can watch. It's not going to completely freak me out.
And if you're really religious, it's very respectful.
Well, it's not respectful, though.
But it
that
comes
number
off.
Was.
Yeah, exactly.
That number was. But a lot of people said, oh, the show soft pedals it. They don't really rip into religion. I'm sorry. I saw the show. They mock religion from beginning to end. And there's no sort of namby-pambiness about it. They don't get all soft soapy and say, well, it's not all bad. No, they mock religion from beginning to end. I was a little surprised. I thought it was going to be a little less caustic, but they don't hold anything back in this show. So if you're easily offended or don't like cursing words, definitely you should stay away. But I thought the number was really good, and I thought it would deliver well. I think the big winner of the night as far as performances was Sister Act.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, they did a great job.
Doing very well. They showed the big number from the show. They highlighted it well. You got the whole cast. And it's also nuns singing and dancing, and people love it. They can't get enough of nuns singing and dancing.
Well, now, you were just talking about the show's direction on television. It did have more viewers than last year. MovieLine has this post about lessons that the Oscars can learn from the Tony Awards. The first thing they say is, give out the smaller awards off-screen, and I thought that really did work.
Well, a lot of these Oscars can't do that. You know, they are obligated to show certain awards on air. They don't have the power to just say, hey, you know what, we're not going to show this. We're not going to show cinematography. They
right.
can't do it.
What I thought worked about that was that you don't have the whole like buildup of here are the nominees and here's the person walking onto the stage and here's the person giving their speech. You just had earlier tonight or moments ago, this happened, you know, the best costume was handed out and here's the winner. And they would cut to the speech and then cut away and you were back live. I thought that worked.
Yeah, I thought that was fine. I mean, they do that at the Oscars as well. So I mean, they do, and Grammys, they do that all the time. They show smaller awards when possible. Earlier this evening, these awards were handed out. So that's not an innovation by the Tonys.
Well, the Oscars don't do that. They hand out all the awards.
Oscars can't. They are not allowed to eliminate awards. The people will not let them. They have no choice.
Well, the unions
cannot. They cannot say, we're bored with this and we don't want to show them on camera. Everybody involved in whatever union it is, be it costume or lighting or cinematography or screenplay, will throw a riot and tear the house down.
Well, right. It's not that they can't. That's the issue. Is that it's another?
It's not an option. They won't let them do it. If I was a producer of the Oscars, that's the first thing I'd want to do, and it wouldn't happen.
And they tried it last year, and there was just rumblings of it, and everybody was up in arms. Now they also say allow for lengthy, spontaneous speeches. I'd have to agree with that. Some of the best speeches were the ones that seemed the most genuine and kind of off the cuff.
Right. Well, Nikki M. James was a supporting actress winner for The Book of Mormon, and she was totally freaked out and excited and gave a very funny, sweet, rambling speech. It was very long. Frances McDormand gave a very good speech when she won Best Actress in a Play for Good People. It was spontaneous and real. Some people, they did play off, so they weren't letting everybody just go as long as they wanted. It's always a question call, but when it feels exciting, yeah, you should definitely let them go on.
And then get rid of the precursors. The Oscars can't do that. I mean, what they're saying is don't have a million award shows leading up to the award show, because then you know who's going to win. Unfortunately for the Oscars, there's no way they can get around that.
Exactly. So it's another thing where they have no choice. They can't eliminate the Golden Globes and the SAG. So, it's another thing. Hey, why don't you do what the Tonys do? Well, we can't.
Right. Well, and the whole being live is a good thing I didn't get. It's like they are live.
I'm sorry, what do you mean being live? They
say, try as they might, the Oscars never feel quote-unquote live. There are very few rough edges during the interminable telecast, and the whole thing seems hermetically sealed. Well, yeah, it's been practiced to within an inch and rehearsed to within an inch of its life.
Huh. I mean, they're both live, so I'm not quite sure. Do they want it to feel less rehearsed?
Well, I guess. And then, finally, I would have to agree with this. Just hire Neil Patrick Harris as the host already.
I thought they said you should actually pair him with Hugh Jackman.
Oh, and they said, yes, you're right. And they say, and pair him with Hugh Jackman. Yeah, the two of those guys together, that would be amazing.
They had great chemistry. I think they should do some movie or something together. They were hilarious. They were really good. They'd be a great, I'd want to think of a Broadway show that, that they could be in together, because they really had a lot of fun chemistry.
Well, yeah, I agree. And do you think that Broadway show would be a success?
Well, it depends on, the show.
Well, if it won a Tony, would it be more successful than if it hadn't won a Tony?
Same thing with the Oscars. It's not really a guarantee of anything. It can boost your self-esteem and your confidence, but it's not any guarantee of success whatsoever.
Well, what did you think then about what the New York Times, they kind of had this weird post about just how much a Tony is worth to its show.
Right. And that's a reasonable thing to talk about, but they did it the wrong way. They looked at shows and said, okay, how much did they make a few weeks right before the Tony Awards? And then how much did they make, say 4 or 6 weeks after the Tony Awards? The Tony Awards is the Tonys and the theater is a very long range planning thing. They all have tours planned and going around the country and around the globe. This is not something that changes week to week. The Book of Mormon, for example, it can't do any better than it's already doing. It's sold out. Unlike a movie, you can't sell more tickets. There's no more seats to be had. What they can do is raise the ticket price, which is exactly what they've done. They jacked up the ticket price another $20. It can't make the show any bigger a hit than it already is. There's only about 1,000 seats in that theater. They're all sold out through September or October already.
So they were pointing to I guess, recent Tony winners. You had what? Fella was selling 82% of its available seats, and Memphis, the ticket sales soared afterwards. So there, those were shows that, though successful already, increased the number of tickets they were selling.
Well, Fela didn't win, but...
Memphis did, so...
Right, it's like the Oscars. If you have the right movie, and it's a small movie, and it hasn't opened wide yet, and it wins the Oscar and gets all that momentum, that can help it jump to the next level. If you have a show that's sort of struggling but gets the stamp of a big Tony Award win, and it's ready and waiting for the audiences and it delivers to them and it's a commercial sort of type of show like Memphis, then yeah, it can help. It's very rare. More often than not, it's just sort of a nice thing as far as the box office in the next few months, but it helps on tour. Memphis is a Tony winner. That means it's a much easier show to sell, and your tickets, when you've got shows that you book 6 months, 8 months in advance, you tell your people in Memphis – or Memphis, excuse me, you tell your people in Illinois, we're bringing the Tony winner for Best Musical, they plunk down their money. They feel confident. Okay, it's got that stamp of approval. So it really helps the tour.
That's so you're saying it helps longer out,
Right. That's why Memphis was on the show again last night. It's still on the boards. It's still selling tickets, but it's not a massive hit, even still a year after it won the Tony. And they're going out on tour, and this just helps raise the visibility of a Broadway show. And they want to prop up a Tony winner, and they want to help sell it and make it seem like a hot property so that it does better on Broadway and on tour and then in high school and college productions for years to come. Not that the Book of Mormon's going to be getting a lot of high school productions, but when a show wins a Tony for Best Musical or Play, that helps it sell itself for all those productions in community theater and high school and colleges. That's a lot of money down the road.
And the New York Times also points out that, yeah, maybe it is hard to kind of do this kind of study, but if you look at what the Tony Award means, maybe it means these shows stay on Broadway for another 3 or 4 years past when they should have been taken off.
No, they didn't say that. Almost no show in history plays for 4 years. That 95% of the shows close down before 4 years. If you run for 4 years, you're one of the longest running hits in history. So
really?
They couldn't have said that.
I'd have to go back and reread the piece, but they were saying how the study is hard to do and that what the Tony Award might mean is that it plays longer on Broadway.
Sure. It can only help. Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, it might play longer on Broadway. But a 4-year run on Broadway is a really, really long time.
So, well, I'd be interested to know of all the Tony winners, how long those runs are as opposed to non-Tony winners.
Well, there's a lot more non-Tony winners than Tony winners. But I would imagine, it tends to, the critical and popular successes tend to go hand in hand in the Tonys, unlike the Oscars. So your biggest hits often win. Cats won the Tony for Best Musical, Rent, Chicago Revival, A Chorus Line, Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis. These were all the Tony winners. In fact, I'm looking at the list of all time. Best Musical, Best Revival. The only one in the top 10 that did not win. Actually, there's three out of the top 10. Seven won the Tony for Best Musical or Drama. O Calcutta was a...
Off-Broadway, I thought.
Off-Broadway, yeah. It depends how you. It is technically, it did run on Broadway at one point, so it is a Broadway show. The Beauty and the Beast, the Disney show, that ran for 5,400 performances. That did not win Best Musical in 1994. And Miss Saigon, did that not win Tony for Best Musical?
No, it didn't.
I wonder what it was beat out by.
But anyway, look, we could go on and on talking about
it. In fact, when I look through the list, chances are if you didn't win the musical, the Tony for Best Musical, the show that beat you out, is also on the list of one of the biggest shows in Broadway history. And therefore, winning a Tony is, in fact, a big deal.
Oh, good, good. I like the way you're moving us right along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. I love the fact that the human centipede has become like this inside joke, not only to myself, you, and Stephen Garrett, who cut the trailer, but now to the entire world.
Is that really an inside joke?
It seems to be. The new horror film, Human Centipede 2, Full Sequence, became one of only 11 films in history to be completely banned in the UK. And that's the United Kingdom, for those of you who don't know that. They didn't give it a strict rating, or even the strictest rating. The UK board insisted the film was so dangerous that it posed a quote-unquote genuine risk to moviegoers and couldn't even be sold on DVD or streamed online in the UK. The original is infamously perverse, even getting shout-outs on sitcoms and animated shows like South Park for its perversity. The UK has banned 11 films, though 8 subsequently were allowed, such as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and classic film, the classic film Freaks as well, Michael. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for the marketing. They just found out what they're going to slap on the cover of their DVD. The film's so dangerous it couldn't be seen in the UK.
I know. If I was the director and producer of this, I'd say thank you very much, United Kingdom. That's one market, and we can now, it's being written about all over the world.
Well, funnily enough, the filmmaker, Tom Six, I think he's Dutch, was actually a little angry. He posted a thing lambasting the board for posting spoilers about what happens in the film on their website.
During Apple's iCloud announcement, they let slip some details. Apple has sold 25 million iPad tablets since the device was launched, and at the iTunes store, they've sold 15 billion songs. As the New York Times pointed out, that's a leap from the 10 billion songs they claimed in February of 2010. That means in 16 months, they've sold an additional 5 billion songs, or the equivalent of 250 million albums at 20 tracks per album. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I was a little confused. I thought, how could they alone have sold 5 billion songs? That would mean, if you add in all the other retailers, that would mean the business is doing actually really well. And then I remembered there are almost no other retailers. It's Apple and Amazon, and that's about it. You're not seeing music stores anymore. So in fact, this number, which seems so out of whack for me, actually kind of makes sense. Well, that's where people are buying music, so that's how much they sold.
Speaking of numbers that are out of whack, NBC made the winning bid for four more Olympics through 2020. Take that, Dick Ebersol. NBC expects to lose anywhere from $400 million to $500 million on its two most recent Olympic broadcasts. Those were in 2010 and the 2012 one coming up in London. So, of course, the new cost-conscious owners of the network doubled down and made a record bid for the next four Olympics that are available from 2014 through 2020. The total comes to $4.3 billion, and there's no indication of how NBC plans to actually make money on the deal. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big, confusing thing. I mean, they came in, Comcast, and said, we're going to pinch pennies and we're not going to waste money. And they've lost hundreds of millions of dollars on the Olympics, but NBC is so desperate. It's in fourth or fifth place, practically, that I think they felt obligated to keep buying the Olympics. I think they felt like to be considered a player, they had to do something. And this was the only thing they could do. The deal makes no sense economically. None.
I wonder if this was an ego thing for...
Exactly. It's big swinging, you know, guys, yeah, we're going to make the biggest bid. We're, you know, just because Dick Ebersol's gone, don't think we can't spend a lot of money. Well, and more importantly, you can't buy a hit sitcom. You can't buy a hit drama. You know, it's something you have to create and get lucky with. You can buy the Olympics. It's a guaranteed rating success story. Even if you spend too much money for it, at least you know people will be looking at your network for a few weeks.
That's true. The Broadway musical Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark has been famously delayed more times than any show in Broadway history. Now it's also affecting rock and roll. Supergroup U2 admitted they wouldn't have a new album out this year as they planned. Bono's back surgery, delays on their world tour, and of course, Bono and the Edge being sucked back into work on Spider-Man has meant the band can't fit more recording into their schedule for a follow-up to No Line on the Horizon. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. They're on tour. It's no big deal that, you know, they should take 3 or 4 years between an album, even though they were so excited by their work on No Line. They said, we're going to have an album out in the middle of the tour. I shouldn't have called them a supergroup. That was my fault. They're not a supergroup. They're, you know, a band who's a huge mega-selling band, but a supergroup is famous people who come together, like, you know, the Traveling Wilburys. So that's my fault. They've been recording a lot with Red One and Danger Mouse, and apparently all the stuff they did with Red One, they're not happy with. Red One's worked with Lady Gaga and Jennifer Lopez. Thought, what are they doing with U2? And I think one of the big reasons why they're not ready with an album is because all the stuff they did with Red One, they decided, this isn't really working for us.
Right,
so
yeah.
I think that's the most telling thing here, along with all Spider-Man and everything else. It's just the stuff they've done, they're not very happy with.
Are you planning to watch a lot of TV this fall, Michael?
I am.
Advertisers sure hope so. The major networks have sold off around 75 to 80% of all their ads for the upcoming season to the tune of $9.25 billion. Actually, if you can't say the word billion dollar in your story, then you're not in Big Deal or Big Whoop this week. That's just the way it works. In the topsy-turvy world of TV, as networks lose audiences to cable and computers, they get to increase what they charge because those eyeballs are harder and harder to track down. So even flailing NBC managed to increase its ad rates. Speaking of cable, the big winners in those channels are the ones with major original programming like TNT and USA, MTV, and others. They're expected to sell an almost identical $9.23 billion in ads for the upcoming season, making TV's cut of the advertising pie more than $18 billion. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. I think it only makes sense that cable should get half or more of the pie because there's hundreds of channels. There's a lot of original programming out there. They should draw more money, but they're increasing the size of the pie. They're making more and more money. It's, you know, TV is huge now. I remember when it was $4 or $5 billion for the upfronts, and now you're looking at $18 billion when you throw in cable. It's amazing.
Is Apple the only game in town when it comes to selling magazines and newspapers to tablet users? The Financial Times said no. They're spurning the Apple Store, along with Apple's demands that it take 30% of all sales and most of the consumer info for itself. FT instead developed a web browser-based app using HTML5. It's optimized for the iPad, but will be adapted for other tablet devices soon. Financial Times says it's easier than coming up with a new app for each and every device out there. How true that is. Plus, of course, they keep all the money and all of the control. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I thought this was a very big deal when it was announced. I don't know why everybody wasn't working aggressively to do the same darn thing. Why would you let Apple be your only pipeline to your customers if you could avoid it, especially with the ridiculous terms they had? And I really thought this would mark a really big break in how Apple dealt with publishers. And that brings us to our next item.
In fact, it's a very big deal because Apple has now agreed publishers can charge what they want, wherever they want, for magazine subscriptions, and that the price on iTunes doesn't have to be the cheapest, forcing publishers to give Apple 30% of their best deal. Also, Apple will share more info among other changes. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? Let me guess. Big deal.
It's a big deal. I mean, the idea that you couldn't charge, that you had to charge the same or less anywhere else that you charge on Apple when they got 30% of the cut was just this unbelievable mind block. I mean, if they're taking 30% of your subscription fee and you can't charge, you know, less than that anywhere else, then you're going to always be losing to Apple unless you increase your fee so much that it becomes, you know, undesirable for your readers. And it made no sense. And I couldn't understand why more and more publishers weren't just saying, screw you.
Well, that's why you know, this comes right after Jan Werner, the publisher of Rolling Stone, the famous publisher of Rolling Stone, kind of lambasted Apple and all the publishers who had raced over to Apple and had willingly gotten into bed with them.
Yeah, I mean, it made no business sense to me whatsoever. I couldn't see how you could agree to it. And I think even with this change in policy that everybody should be doing what the Financial Times is doing and making sure that they have their own way of reaching their customers. Because if the experience is just as good, and I don't see why it shouldn't be, why not?
Just as the venerable crime drama CSI reclaims the title as the most watched TV show in the world, lead actor Lawrence Fishburne announced he'd be exiting early after 2.5 seasons and just weeks before they start filming season 12. No word on any possible replacement, though Kurt Russell's name was in the mix the last time around when they replaced William Peterson. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it is a big deal. I mean, CSI is not the massive force it used to be, but it's still a big, big hit in the U.S. and a part of a franchise of series. And it's obviously the biggest, most watched show around the world, just like Baywatch and CSI Miami have been in the past. Having your lead actor take off like just a few weeks before the show begins filming its new season, it's a little strange. I still don't think we know exactly why he left, whether it was just unhappiness with the role or some other issue, or everything's fine with him. But you definitely want to fix this soon, because even though it's 12 years in, it's still a property that matters to CBS.
Hey, Michael, can you name some of the biggest publishers in comics?
I think so.
Well, DC and Marvel are the major leaders, but a new player in the business is Kickstarter. Wait, Kickstarter? Isn't that the website where people with a project can get outsiders to kick in contributions and make it happen? Yep, and comic books and graphic novels are proving very popular at attracting funding. Kickstarter was the source of key funding for 10 books and 15 single issues of comics last year, putting it on par with DC's major imprint, Vertigo. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a kind of a big deal. We've seen this with recording artists where they say, hey, I want to do a new album. They have a fan base. And I think with comic books, somehow it's even easier to show them examples of what you want to do. Unlike a movie or something else, you can say, hey, look, here are the first few pages, and you can see their visual style. So I think you have a lot more faith. It's sad that people have to turn to their fans to make something happen. But as seed money for a project, it's kind of fascinating that they would be sort of like a publisher.
Well, you know, the reason that, Kickstarter isn't publishing them
outright.
But the reason that projects like that do so well is because, you know, you actually get something at the end of it. It's you get the comic book, or you get the album, or you get the DVD. So
which you would have wanted to buy anyway, obviously, or you're not a fan, or you wouldn't pay for it.
Right, exactly.
But it's kind of interesting. It's kind of a crazy way that nobody seems to be able to do anything on their own anymore. They have to like raise the funds, and they have to do everything from PR to raising money.
Yeah, well, it's the do-it-yourself generation.
Yeah. Oh, except the X generation, the Y generation, we're the DIY generation.
Yes,
indeed. You might have just come up with a new book.
Oh, wait a second.
You know,
write
that
one down.
Point, the DIY generation. Right? No, copyrighted.
Trademark it. Well, you know, speaking of doing it yourself, actor, writer, director, teacher, student, and now musician. Renaissance man James Franco has an EP scheduled to come out in July. Now EP standing for?
Extended play.
Instead of LP, which stands for?
Long play.
That's right. Well, I'm trying to get Michael on one of these acronyms. So his EP is going to be called Turn It Up. It features Franco declaiming lyrics while a collaborator churns out some crazy, hazy music behind him. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I like James Franco, but I'd have to say Big Whoop, especially since I listened to one of the tracks.
You want to listen to one of them now? Should we play it for our listeners?
If you must, not the whole thing.
It's broken.
This pain in me has arrested me.
It's broken.
This pain in me has arrested me.
It's
this pain in me has arrested me.
Actually, I don't want to be too mockable. I think it's actually very cool that he's using his opportunity to do all sorts of fun, different stuff, like direct a short film based on a poem, take classes at college, perform on General Hospital, do this EP, whatever. And it's not all going to work, but I actually think it's kind of cool that he's sort of just taking whatever he can to do creative stuff.
Lloyds of London want to be starting something with concert promoter AEG Live. Lloyds is suing AEG Live over the series of Michael Jackson concert in Insured. It's trying to convince a judge that the insurance policy should be nullified and insists that AEG Live is not, or perhaps did not in the past, provide necessary information about Jackson's medical history and details about Dr. Conrad Murray, who was later charged with involuntary manslaughter in Jackson's death. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for AEG Live. I can't imagine that Lloyds of London is going to be able to claim that they didn't have enough knowledge to know that Michael Jackson was a serious risk.
Yeah, I mean, give me a break. Why is it that every time there's an insurance claim, you hear the insurance company trying to get out of it? It's ridiculous.
That's their business, baby, to not pay, to take your money for insuring them and not pay when you need to claim.
Yeah, unbelievable.
That's how they make their money. If they paid out, they wouldn't make as much money.
Yeah, and of course, this is not an industry that needs to be regulated in any way. Oh, that Tracy was Alec Baldwin's initial tepid response to actor Tracy Morgan's ugly jokes at a concert in Nashville where he said being gay was a choice, said gays should stop bitching about being bullied, and said if his son came out and didn't talk like a man, that Morgan would grab a knife and stab him to death. Hilarious, right? Everyone has roundly denounced his comics, from NBC to co-stars Baldwin and Tina Fey to regular guest star and out actor Cheyenne Jackson. Morgan himself apologized, said he clearly went too far and that it was, quote, not funny in any context. My friends know what is in my heart. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. He's not an actor that matters as far as, you know, his personal attitudes. He's kind of a nutty, crazy, goofy guy. Chris Rock had a comment. He said he initially downplayed and said, oh, whatever. I don't want to live in a world where Tracy Morgan can't say crazy stuff.
Well,
he later said, you know what, looking at it now, I always treat everything he says so dismissively because he's a little off. But in fact, what he said was really out of bounds and it's wrong, blah, blah, blah. The only thing I find interesting about this is how we get everybody's comments so quickly via Twitter and online, and it's unmitigated from, you know, a press release via the studio. It's just directly from them.
I know.
You know, Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, Chris Rock, Wanda Sykes, everybody weighs in quickly and clearly, and you know it's coming straight from them.
Tracy Morgan, I saw him on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he came out and did a little guest spot there, and Jon Stewart was handling him with kid gloves because Tracy Morgan's just crazy. He's insane. And he had no idea what Morgan was going to do. So he was just kind of like, I don't know what I want to do with this guy. But that kind of leads to our next and last big deal or big whoop topic is Jon Stewart's The Daily Show a comedy show or a politics show? Well, it's definitely entertainment and people tune in for it for a lively point of view, just like they tune into, say, Fox News. So how does Stewart compare to rivals like Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity? He beats them handily. In fact, he beats almost every personality show on all the 24 cable news networks. Stewart reached 2.3 million people a night in May, according to Nielsen, or I should say viewers. That's more than virtually everyone except Bill O'Reilly, who reaches 2.8 million. More than most everyone on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. This points as much to the decline of the cable news channels as it does to the lure of Stewart. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal, and like you said, it's really showing how much the mighty have fallen. I mean, even Bill O'Reilly was reaching like 5 or 6 million viewers a night at one point, if not more. So he's down to 2.8 million, and Stewart is beating out everybody else. You know, they're not getting their news from Stewart, but they are definitely getting their political point of view, which is what they tune into, to Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann on Current TV and Bill O'Reilly. And Jon Stewart is definitely right there with them. He could be on any of those channels doing what he does. And I think it's great. Thank God they're turning into him.
That concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the news stories that only people in the entertainment industry might care about. And this week, we figured we'd focus on what Apple did last week, which was announce iCloud. And this is it's so broad and confusing and twisted, but we'll focus just on the music application part of it. Does that make sense, Michael?
It does. So who are the competitors?
So we got Google, and they have this thing called Music Beta, which allows you to upload 20,000 songs. You have to upload them from your computer to their servers. Then you have the Amazon Cloud Player, which has a store, something Google doesn't have. And so you can download songs from their store into your Cloud Player or from your hard drive to their...
You're making it confusing.
To their servers. So in other words, you're putting all of your music up in the cloud on Amazon or Google servers.
But you have to upload it. It's not that they're going to identify it?
That's correct, because none of them have licenses. So neither Amazon or Google have licenses, and the way they get around being sued by the labels is, hey, it's not our, it's just data files. It's not even our data files. It's their data files. Go sue them. Go sue the customers.
And so what does iTunes do differently?
Well, they have an unlimited space for iTunes purchases in their iCloud.
Just like Amazon.
And everything is stored in the cloud. However, they will scan your iTunes library. And out of the 18 million songs that they have on file, they will, instead of having you upload them, they will match your songs for $25 per year to the cloud.
But it's, well, if you purchase the music on iTunes, it's up there automatically and free. You don't have to pay.
Right, correct. That is correct.
Right, just like Amazon. If you buy it from them, they will store it for you for free.
Correct.
If you want to have your rest of your music, you know, available in the cloud, they will scan your stuff, and for $25 a year, you can get access to it on any, you know, one of a dozen devices, basically.
Right, but then it gets really confusing.
It's not already?
The iTunes iCloud, no streaming. So you can download, but you can't stream it. So you still have to have it on your device to listen to it.
So you can't access all your music. I thought the one point that reason I would want the iCloud was because I could access my, you know, 500,000 songs.
Right, that
but
is correct.
I can't
correct.
Do that because I have to limit myself to the capacity of my device, just like I do right now.
Or go to the Amazon Cloud Player or Music Beta by Google.
Right, and in those cases, you have to have access to a Wi-Fi or an internet connection of some sort so that you can stream.
Yeah, 3G. I mean, you can do it over 3G, but...
Well, sure, yeah. You want to pay the money.
But I think that the reason... Now, a couple points here. One, let's say I've pirated a whole bunch of 128 kilobit per second music. Well, now what Apple is saying is, don't worry, pay us that $25 a year. We'll scan your iTunes library, find all that pirated music, and then we will give you 256 kilobit per second DRM-free AAC files.
Blah, 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 blah. They increase, they keep a sound file in the cloud of the best possible quality.
Right. But
so no matter when you ripped your CD, it's not about being a pirate. If you just ripped your CD years ago to a lower level of MP3 quality, they're not going to obviously mimic your bad sound quality. They're going to provide the best sound quality that they have and the best file that they have.
Right. But what has been pointed out is that if people have pirated music, they're not differentiating between a ripped CD legally.
Well, they can't.
Right. Exactly. So
it's not their fault.
But the $25 per year that Apple is asking you to pay, some of that goes to the record labels.
Right. So they might actually make some money off of it. It's not like... Everybody who's pirated music is going to say, oh, wow, now I can upgrade my music for $25 a year. That's not the big draw here. It's just a practical side effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's not some sort of free pass or easy out for people who pirate. In fact, they got to start paying money, which they never did before.
Right. Now, as far as offline options, you mentioned recently played songs are cached in Google. You can download some of the songs from Amazon to your device. And you have to download on the iTunes iCloud, so you can download to 10 authorized devices. If you're in the Apple world, the iCloud may make sense. It syncs everything. You can pick which tracks are downloaded to each device. But if you're not, then some of these other services like Amazon and the Music Beta by Google might make more sense.
Well, the only thing that appealed to me was the idea that I could have my iPhone but access all my music and not have to download it onto my iPhone. Because I thought, okay, using this service now, I can be somewhere and stream music and listen to everything on my – I don't have to decide what albums I want to listen to in advance. I can have access to all of it. But in fact, it's not true.
I completely agree with you. I think that that this is, that is exactly what I was hoping for. And instead what I get is, no, you still have to have, you know, all the storage in the world to take everything with you if you want everything. Really, this is just syncing back and forth. It's iSync more than it is iCloud. And I think that the labels prevented that. I think they did not want streaming because that would be broadcast and they didn't want to interfere with the deals they were cutting with Spotify and radio and Rhapsody and all these other services.
But if you've already bought the music, why would they care?
That's what I think. But again, the labels aren't exactly, you know, sane smart when it comes to these things.
Maybe it was because Apple was worried about people streaming constantly. And they thought, you know what, we've already got our iPhones and our iPads overloaded. And if we allow people to stream all their music, that'll just increase the possibility that they'll be using this 24 hours a day. You know, we've got to do something to maintain our pipeline and not keep it overloaded. We're already freaked out about, you know, people using Netflix and all that stuff and Hulu. Why are we going to give them something else to stream constantly?
Right. And I mean, I think a lot of the things, not only in the iCloud, but, you know, all of the stuff that OS X Lion and all of the other things that were announced by Apple last Monday, including iCloud, they're playing catch up. I mean, they're really just saying, hey, look what we have, email on your phone. I mean, they're not saying that, but a lot of the features are things that other providers have had for some time. And then Apple mentions it and it's like the holy grail, you know, the holy grail, like as if nobody's ever invented it before. And so mark my words, 3 to 4 years from now, you're going to hear, and now you can stream your music. Now, streaming is when, and you'll hear them explain it as if somehow it's something new and everybody will go, genius.
But do you have any sense of like the fact that, look, they're already overwhelmed their networks?
No, well, available. I think in part it is that they know that if they offered streaming now, they will kill their network partners, whether it's Verizon or AT&T here in the United States or overseas, any of those partners. So they are only giving the public as much as the public can actually technically use today.
This brings me back to my point. I guess I see the idea of the iCloud and the syncing. I guess that's where it starts to make a little sense to me. I've always been very skeptical. But I guess when you talk about, gee, it's so hard to keep track of what's on your laptop, what's on your netbook, what's on your iPad, what's on your iPhone, what's on your calendar here and there, to have it all automatically synced up all the time makes some sense to me. Now I start to see the possibilities or why this service might be important and valuable to people who have home, work, and mobile devices.
I completely agree. But at the same time, I don't think it goes far enough. And for me, it's a, really? That's all you're giving me? I didn't really need. It's nice for backups, that I will say.
And it's not a backup service, though.
Right. And it would be.
I think it's just more easier to not have to, you know, to make sure my iPad and my iPhone and my laptop all have the same calendar information. I have to sync them all up together.
Well, that's iCloud sync. But yeah, I mean, I'm just talking about the music.
Well, the music, again, I mean, you linked to a study from Music With Me, who I'm not even familiar who they are, but they claim that most people have about 5,000 songs.
Well, they say that, yeah, that Music With Me is an app for Android, and it syncs your iTunes, you know, on your computer to your Android device. So
right.
They found that their app has found an average of 5,409 songs in people's iTunes libraries, of which only 1,214 get played regularly, or 19%.
Well, that makes total sense, but that means people own about 500 albums, which is
about
certainly
right.
My experience. Most people don't own that many albums, if at all. So again, you can fit all your albums on your iPhone anyway, so why do you need the stupid iCloud service?
Well, because you want to sync them back and forth. And yeah. And if you were to ask Hypebot, they actually have four reasons why the iCloud is important. They said, first, it's the first license locker, and that is true. At least the music labels are beginning to play.
Wake up.
Yeah. They say that it may change the future of owning music versus renting. In other words, if Spotify was really going to take off and people were going to say, that's it, we're never going to buy music again, we'll just rent. Well, maybe having it in your own personal locker might change people's minds, and they'll continue to buy music, which makes the record companies more money. And the record companies are making money again from old music. So all of that old music you have in your iTunes library, well,
only because of your $25 a year fee.
Yes, correct.
And that's only for music that you didn't purchase from iTunes. So if you've been buying all your music from iTunes for years, you don't need to pay the $25 fee and they won't be making any money.
Right. I mean, the label will get 58% of that $25. The publisher of the music will get 12%, and then the rest will go to Apple. So
if it's music you've purchased outside of iTunes.
Correct. Yes.
Could I spend $25 and upgrade the sound quality of all my digital files on my iTunes library.
That is what I'm trying to figure out. In other words, if I can do that and I'll pay the $25, can I download that higher quality music?
Well, you
have
to download it, right?
That's what I think. But
because
in other words,
they say you can't keep it in the cloud. You've got to have it downloaded if you want to listen to it. So if you get the better sound quality, that's worth $25 for me. That's for sure.
Yeah, I pay $50 a year for that. But here's my question: if I stop paying the $25, do all the files stop working?
No, that can't be.
That's what I think. I mean,
you've already owned it. They're just they can't take it away from you. You bought that album separately on a CD. I did. So they can't say just because they've upgraded your sound quality, they can't say, never mind, we're taking it back.
Yeah, well, you never know.
You never know. Oh, well.
Yeah, well, and, we have a story here about Richard Dreyfuss reading the iTunes eulogy, but we are running long, so we probably should get into listener email since we plugged it at the head of the show. Michael, do you want to read this email?
Sure. Hi, Sperling and Michael. In the last podcast, you were discussing the pricing of ebooks on the Amazon store and how one sometimes pay more for ebooks than the paper equivalent. During that discussion, Michael used the oft-heard phrase, information wants to be free, as a justification for the downward pressure on ebook prices. That phrase originated with Stuart Brand, who founded the Whole Earth catalog. However, Brand's full statement paints a very different picture than the everything should be free ethos that some people have taken it to mean. Brand said, quote, on the one hand, information wants to be expensive because it's so valuable. The right information in the right place just changes your life. On the other hand, information wants to be free because the cost of getting it out is getting lower and lower all the time. So you have these two fighting against each other, end quote. And that's a quote he pulled from Wikipedia. Yes, the distribution costs of ebooks versus printed books should mean that the cost of books will continue to shift and shift downward. But I think it is misleading to think that free is where everything is heading or that we should even want it to head there. Like Brand said, the right information in the right place changes your life, and that is worth something. Keep up the great work. Cheers. Andrew Einsbruck, Wild Pure Heart Productions in Braidwood, Australia.
Yes, and wildpureheart.com. is his domain name, his website.
I made him sound Teutonic when I said Einsbruck, but I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. I appreciate him clarifying what Stuart Brand meant when he used that phrase. I didn't realize that was the implication. If I said information wants to be free, I wasn't implying that I thought creative copy content should be free. Far from it. I don't think that at all. So especially since I create this stuff. I don't think that at all. I don't think everything should be free. I think you should expect and want to pay for stuff if you like it. So I thought because the digital file is so much easier to promulgate that it should be at least as expensive, if not less expensive, than a printed version. That was the point I was trying to make. But thanks for clarifying what that phrase means and where it comes from.
And actually, when you said it last week, I was going to bring up the actual origin of the phrase, but I could not remember Stuart Brand's name. And I had read about the origin of that phrase in a book by Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired Magazine, his book Free. And it's a very interesting book. And he talks about that phrase and what free means and cross-subsidization and you know, how everything is headed toward free. Great book if you get a chance to read it. And again, thank you very much, Andrew, for sending in your email. You can send us an email if you agree with us or disagree with us, although apparently you cannot disagree more with Michael because that's my job. So you can't do that. Dirt@showbizsandbox is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. For those of you out of the country, that's +1-888-567-7263. Now, you can find all of that contact information, as well as links to all of the stories we discussed on today's show, all of our past episodes, ways to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or RSS or the Zune Marketplace, our Twitter account, which is twitter.com/showbizsandbox, our Facebook account, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz's work can often be found on the Huffington Post or on his website, michaelgiltz.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.